The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is Tuesday, March the 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day to all of you Irish men, women, and children out there. I'm part Irish myself in my soul and my heart. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum, although they're not all at the table. They are eating cookies behind the table. We'll start with the two lats bill. And so, Senator Latz, why don't we have you come on up? And then we're going to invite for the overview over this package of bills that has to do with Second Chance. Today is Second Chance Day in the Judiciary Committee. We're going to have Judge Pam Alexander, who is the current president of the Council on Crime and Justice, and Mr. Phil Carruthers, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney, come up to the table. Members, Judge Alexander and Mr. Carruthers are going to, Speaker Carruthers are going to do overviews. And then we will have Senator Latz begin with his bill and his testifiers. So, Judge Alexander, Senator Latz.
Did you want me to wait while they make the presentation? Or?
You can sit right there. Okay. Because they're speaking in support of your bills too. So.
I like that.
Judge Alexander, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The theme I think that we should have this afternoon is that Minnesota may be in a state of perpetual punishment. Before I continue on this theme, however, let me tell you that in my 25 years as a district court judge, I did not hesitate to punish and punish severely when it was appropriate. However, it was my understanding that in most cases, the punishment had a clear end, a point where the defendant paid their debt and would be given a fair chance, if they chose to fully regain their fully rejoin their community, rebuild their lives and support their families and redeem themselves. But I became increasingly concerned when defendants will call the council long after their sentence was complete and tell me about the difficulties they were having in finding employment and housing. I became concerned not just about the injustice of the situation, but about its implications for public safety. Ex-offenders who find stable employment and housing are much less likely to reoffend. This is one reason I chose to join the Council on Crime and Justice, why I'm grateful to be able to talk to you today about the state of collateral punishment in Minnesota, and why I support the effort represented by the bills being heard today to begin to end this perpetual punishment cycle. For the past 25 years or so, Minnesota, along with the rest of the United States, has increasingly tried to solve the problem of crime with just one solution, and that's punishment. Although Minnesota has been moderate in our use of incarceration compared to other states, our prison population has still grown about 300% in the last 20 years. But our relatively low use of incarceration does not mean we have done better compared to other states overall. A recent report of the Pew Center on the state showed that Minnesota now has the eighth highest percentage of adults in one form of correctional control, a 278% increase in their per capita rate since 1982. In this context of ex-offenders being able to move beyond their past, it's important to note that whenever someone goes to prison or not, the collateral consequences of the conviction are greatly just as severe. While the rate of incarceration has grown, it has become more and more difficult for ex-offenders to successfully move beyond their past, support their families, and become fully contributing members of our community. Over the years, the severity of statutory prohibitions on the hiring of ex-offenders has expanded exponentially. These statutory barriers have become really so numerous, complex, and onerous that we've reached a real sad state of affairs where young people trying to better their lives through education are not even informed that their past mistakes will keep them from working in certain occupations until after they've already invested their time, their money, and their hopes and their dreams. In addition to statutory barriers, the general stigma of a criminal record keeps ex-offenders from accessing housing and employment. Research that we've done on the council in this area indicates that applicants with a criminal record are the least likely to be hired, When someone checks the yes box on employment applications about criminal history, the odds that their application will be thrown out or put into the do not hire pile, even if the record is not relevant to the position they're applying for, or the conviction is over 10, 15, or even 20 years old. Our research also showed us that a number of employers conducting criminal background checks have roughly doubled in the past 10 years. At one point, the only place you could get criminal history was the courts. Now we have many private institutions that are collecting and disseminating records. We have found through the research that we've done that a lot of this is inaccurate and in some cases unregulated, and reports things that have no relevance to employers or landlords, but nevertheless create fear and confusion. Access to even juvenile records, once considered protected, has also increased, preventing even the youngest members of our community from reaching their fullest potential. These barriers and issues would be easier to overcome if Minnesota could provide some remedies for individuals with a criminal record. Unfortunately, currently we have little to offer. In some states, employers are prohibited from discriminating against someone based on a non-conviction record or just an arrest record or certain types and ages of convictions. Minnesota has no such protection. Some other states strongly regulate private data companies. Minnesota does not. Minnesota has a record of sealing remedies through the expungement process, but recent case law has made it unclear if any record of a conviction can ever be sealed at the executive branch. Juvenile expungement procedure is unclear, and the types of expungement available under the current expungement statute are very limited. The process itself is so difficult and costly that it's nearly unavailable to the majority of the people who would most benefit. There are some possible solutions to these problems. One that is probably the most important but not being addressed today is the need to reverse the trend of simply increasing the length and severity of punishment. I hope that will be addressed on another day. But for those who have already paid the debt we have decided they should pay, we need to create policies that will make it easier for them to rejoin their communities and become contributing members. We need to fund programs that help ex-offenders with a difficult transition back into society, especially those that need help with employment, housing, mental health, and substance abuse treatment. I believe we need to work with the business community and property owners and pass legislation to help them develop policies and procedures that will allow ex-offenders to be evaluated based on their skills and qualifications and character, not just only their past mistakes. We need to more securely protect the records of our kids and juveniles so that they can reach their fullest potential. In conclusion, it is not only the hundreds of thousands of Minnesota ex-offenders who suffer under the state of perpetual punishment. Their children also suffer when their parent can't get a job or housing. We suffer as taxpayers and community members when they don't succeed. Employers suffer when they discount their skills and talents. And we all suffer when we create a society where complete redemption is not possible. And although the impact of these issues has a disproportionate impact upon communities of color and the poor, it is a situation that overall diminishes the safety and prosperity and justice of every community throughout the state of Minnesota. Thank you for having me this afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you for your eloquent words. Speaker Carruthers.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. My position is that I'm the director of the prosecution division for the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. We've made available a set of principles that have been adopted by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And I want to run through those quickly, and I do have some extra copies if people need them. Happy to make those available to via page. First thing that I'd like to say, Madam Chair, is that this has been a difficult issue, I think, over the years, because it seems like both sides have not necessarily been able to reach a resolution of the issue. I think it's something that that with more discussion and work, a lot of compromises can be worked out. And I want to say that our organization and myself personally are very interested in being part of the dialogue and how to make some progress on this, because this committee has had several hearings on it, other committees have, and we as prosecutors know it's a big problem, the issue that Judge Alexander raises. We're for redemption as prosecutors. We want people to turn their lives around. All of us make mistakes, and we recognize as prosecutors that, yes, people make mistakes, but that does not mean that we should write them off. We should make sure that they have the opportunity to put a crime, a conviction behind them, and to move forward in their life. It's extremely important for society that they do that. And so we support efforts for reform so that ex-offenders can gain employment and housing, and we think that that will have the effect of increasing public safety. The kind of principles that we approach it is to think, well, what goals should society and the legislature be trying to accomplish when you look at the issue of expungement? And, you know, pretty much I think it's fair to say that anybody with a criminal conviction would just as soon have it expunged if possible. But what kinds of expungements does the legislature and does society want to encourage? And I think the ones that you want to encourage are the ones where a person has truly changed his or her life, where they've been law-abiding for a certain period of time, where they carried out and successfully completed their probation, where they've made restitution. Very important, if they have a treatment requirement that was part of their sentence, that they completed successfully their treatment, because society and the legislature, I think, want to encourage people with chemical dependency problems to complete their chemical dependency treatment, because if they don't, they're probably just ultimately going to get back into the criminal justice system. As prosecutors, we see a huge percentage of cases where offenders are chemically dependent. And unfortunately, many of the ones that have multiple offenses, it's because they haven't dealt with their underlying chemical dependency problem. So one of the points that we make in this paper, I draw your attention to number 8, is if the legislature is going to amend the law on expungement, we would suggest that the person who's making the petition show that essentially they deserve the expungement. Things like their chemical record, their criminal record has been clean for at least 5 years. They successfully completed chemical dependency treatment and aftercare. They've made full payment of court-ordered restitution, and that there has been some waiting period over which they have not had any new offense. That kind of thing. That then gives the offender the incentive to redeem themselves, to show that they've become a good citizen, and society then is getting the benefit of a person who has done that and as a result is now ready to become a full contributing member of society and to have that criminal record expunged. There are reasons that we should there should be a presumption of openness in the criminal justice system. That is a very important protection against tyranny. That's one of the points that we make. If you expunge an offense, it can affect people well beyond just the offender himself or herself. If a dangerous offender is hired for a job as to which there are some public safety issues, then that can affect the employer, the employees, vulnerable adults, and others. Where there is expungement, records should be sealed, not destroyed. When expungement is granted, then prosecutors, law enforcement, and social services should continue to have access to these records because it is important criminal justice information that may be important in solving crimes or in dealing with sentencing issues. Also, there are highly responsible jobs or professions where the legislature should be careful about granting access to arrest and correction and conviction information. For example, if somebody wants to be a work in the financial services industry where they have responsibility over a great deal of money, that employer should have the ability to access this, even though perhaps it's not a statutorily mandated background check. For the public protection, that employer should at least have the option, if that employer wants, of doing a background check and should be able to get access to relevant convictions. I think the judge made a very important point about how criminal justice records can be in error, and it's very important, and we totally support efforts to correct inaccurate records. It's very important that we have an ability to do that, and we support that. And then also one of the other points that we would make is there should be liability, limited liability for release of expunged records, so that if we do release records pursuant to what we think is an expungement order, but we should not have to worry about being sued, and the same thing to other agencies. I would also suggest that there may be certain types of offenses that you want to exclude from expungement. Right now, Chapter 609A excludes serious sex offenses, for example. You may want to think about drunk driving. Do you want to have drunk driving be something that can be expunged? Because if a drunk driving arrest is expunged, then essentially the rest of the motoring public is going to have to bear the risk of that whose rates would normally go up, and now that that rate increase is not occurring, and as a result, the rest of the motoring public has to pay for that risk. So those would be a few points that we'd make. And in terms of the bills, I would on Senator Latz's bill, 538. I just want to point out we generally be supportive of this. But there are some agencies where there's no statutory required background check, but where these agencies would still want to do a background check, like financial, for example, Department of Commerce, people dealing with financial information, or prosecutor's office. On Senate File 1097, the Certificate of Good Conduct, that's something that we support as prosecutors. However, there is one provision in there that says that a person who gets a Certificate of Good Conduct, they're relieved of any state-imposed collateral sanction. And I would raise the question, what about as to a licensing board? And the language was, in my opinion, a little unclear there as to whether once this person has gotten a Certificate of Good Conduct, can a licensing board take into consideration the underlying conviction? So, for example, somebody has a financial fraud conviction, and they've made good efforts at redeeming themselves. They get a certificate of good conduct, and now they want to become licensed as a financial planner or as an insurance agent. Should the licensing board at least be able to consider that? And I was nervous in reading the language that it looked like that would actually be prohibited. And I think that our licensing boards, we have to give them some discretion as to figure out whether a person is, in fact, somebody who should be licensed. I like the idea of giving them the opportunity to be licensed, but it should not be an automatic, essentially, bar on a licensing board considering their prior conviction once they've had a certificate of good conduct. And so those would be the comments that I'd make. The biggest point I'd want to make is that we as prosecutors, we want to be part of the discussion. We want to be part of efforts to try to work out some compromises on this.
Well, Speaker Carruthers, glad to have you, your comments before the committee. As you see on our agenda today and all the co-authors of all the bills that are on the agenda today, there's a bipartisan desire to work on this in this second chance package. I think this committee has shown by the authors and the bills that are before this committee today that it's a direction that we intend to move in. So glad to have you here and glad to have your comments, and we'll be looking forward to working with you and the prosecutors on this. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And actually, Senator Latz, you have a testifier, right?
I do.
Is it Ms. Jackson?
It is.
Why don't we have Ms. Jackson come up to the table? Okay. 538.
Madam Chair, Senate File 538 would require public employers to go through the application process initially before they conduct a criminal history check, and actually to wait until they get to the stage of selecting someone for an interview before they make a criminal background check. And the purpose of this is to ensure that all applicants, regardless of their criminal background, are given at least a fair consideration on the merits of the qualifications for the job they're applying for, rather than being automatically or inappropriately rejected because they have a criminal history that may or may not be directly relevant to the performance of the job they are seeking. As you will hear from Ms. Jackson, it is not uncommon for applicants with a criminal history to never make it past the resume stage on the application, simply because they've got a criminal background. And it's easier for an employer, a potential employer, to say, we're just not going to consider those folks. We got plenty of applicants who don't have criminal history, so let's just forget them, and we'll look at the ones that have clean records. Not only might they be losing potentially great employees for the particular position they're looking for, but it makes it really, really hard for people who have a criminal history to re-enter society. When they are released from custody, they are often given conditions like find a job and support yourself and find housing and so on. And if they can't find a job, they can't earn an income, they can't find housing, they can't take care of any children they may have, it makes life much more difficult. And frankly, it increases the stresses in their lives to the point where they could end up recommitting offenses and then back into the prison system. And that doesn't do anyone any good. We are all better off if they can find gainful employment and take care of their obligations to the community. So that's the purpose of the bill. I do have an amendment I'd like to ask for, but first I think I'd like the committee to hear from Lisa Jackson, who has experienced some of these barriers firsthand.
Ms. Jackson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Lisa Jackson. I thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm a woman that has been incarcerated for 4.5 years. I was released from prison, and like Senator said, you're released from prison under conditions that you find a job, you do well, and you do all of those things. Since I've been released from prison, it's been very difficult finding employment. Every place I go, you know, once you get to that particular part of the application where you have to check being a felon, and I think it's something that box doesn't show. That box doesn't show who I am. Yes, I might have committed a crime and made a mistake in my life, but that box being checked does not give me the opportunity to get in the door for an employment to even meet me, to even see the qualifications I have, the skills I have, what kind of assets that I will be for that company. So I truly feel that box has really hindered me in employment. It has really hindered me in taking care of my son because, like I said, when you're released, you're supposed to find a job. You're supposed to take care of your family and your household and your children and all of those things. But without anyone giving us a chance to even get our feet in the door, to even talk about hiring us for a position, it's like the doors are just shut in our faces. And it's really hard. And, you know, when you can't get employment, like Senator said, that makes some people go back into the system. You know, you don't find a job, and it's like your back is up against the wall. I have made a mistake in my life, but I spent 4.5 years in prison. rehabilitating myself, doing everything and anything that I could to make myself be a better person. And I looked forward to coming out here, re-entering back into society, finding me a job, living an honest and decent life, and it's really has been hard. It's just a stone wall there. And we are definitely looking for a breakthrough so we can show society that we can make mistakes in our lives. And we can change. We can rehabilitate ourselves. We can make a positive impact on our community. And that's what we're asking for today.
Thank you. Did you say you have an amendment, Senator Latz?
I do. Madam Chair, just briefly, the two provisions in the first engrossment that you have before you would provide that a public employer may not inquire into or consider the criminal record of history of an applicant for public employment until after the applicant has been selected for the interview. And then paragraph B makes two exceptions. One exception is for the Department of Corrections. Given the unique nature of almost all of their positions in the department, and that places them on equal footing with all of the law enforcement agencies in the state of Minnesota, which under a separate provision in this chapter have the same protection. And the other is to public employers who have a statutory duty to conduct a criminal background check or take into consideration a potential employee's criminal history. There are just certain jobs that statutes prohibit you from working in. If that's the kind of a job that is involved, then they should be able to conduct that background check at the initial screening portion of the application. In consultation with the Inter-County Association and Mr. Carlson from them, I have asked counsel to draft up an amendment which does one more thing, and that is to state that it's the amendment A3, and I would ask, have that passed out.
All the members have the A3 amendment.
Okay. It would provide that this proposal does not prohibit a public employer from notifying applicants of positions where either the law or the employer's policy would disqualify them from successfully achieving that job position if a criminal background check were done. Nothing in this bill would change or force an employer to change their policy with regard to whether or not they're going to employ someone with any or a particular criminal history. But the A3 amendment would say that they can provide notice to the applicants, and I would anticipate then applicants would self-screen. If they know that they're not going to qualify based on their history, it'll save them not only the time and money of applying, but the embarrassment and the emotional stress of being turned down for a job after they've gone through the application process. So I would ask if a member of the committee would offer the A3 amendment.
Senator Scheid moves the A3 amendment. Any questions for Senator Latz on the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair,
I do.
Senator Limmer? Senator Olson?
Well, Madam Chair, I just am looking at the wording of the A3 amendment, and I'm not sure that the wording is very descriptive of what Senator Latz just explained. And I guess I'm just thinking from notifying applicants of positions where law or the employer's policy, I mean, it's talking about notifying them about positions as opposed to notifying them about the policy. And so to me, when I first read this, I wasn't even quite sure what exactly that meant. I think what it means is from notifying applicants that the employer's policy or that the law or the employer's policy would disqualify an individual with a particular criminal history from employment in that position or something. But it's really seems to be kind of modifying the positions. Mm-hmm. And so you're just saying you could tell the applicants about those positions, and I don't know, I just think it's not worded correctly.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I don't have any pride of authorship here. I know I think Ms. Pontius may have drafted the amendment, and I just saw it when it was handed out. But I
I think you want to keep the law in there because the law may require the background check. So, or it may be the employer's policy about a certain position. So it says that to me, but maybe you could say the law. But I don't know that you even need that.
No.
We have a suggestion.
I don't hear a motion, so I can't act unless there's a motion.
Madam Chair, and I thank you.
Ms. Pontius? Apparently, Senator Olson would like to amend the amendment so that on line 1.3, delete of, line 0.4, delete position where, and insert that. And on line 1.5, delete those and insert particular. Mm-hmm. On Senator Olson to amend the amendment.
I'm sure. You took out the word particular and replaced it with those.
Line 1.5, delete the word those and insert particular. So the amendment.
Madam Chair.
Yes?
There's the word particular on the line above at 1.4. Do you want to keep that particular?
Position.
Yes.
I think so.
So you want the word particular to show twice in the same sentence?
Madam Chair?
Am I getting this right?
Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, yes. I think that because one kind of a criminal history background may not prevent. Just having a criminal history background may not, but a particular kind, I'm assuming, of record would be prohibited by law or by the employer's policy. So I don't think having particular actually references the background and then the position they're applying for, that they may be applying for. So I think it, again, I don't know if you have another word for particular, but I think specific.
Specific would be here we go. About the same, would do the same thing, but it's a.
Madam Chair, is the purpose of isolating a particular element of a criminal history background that is not being identified in the purpose of this provision. So an employer can isolate either a particular or a specific criminal history background at their choosing? Is that how this
Senator Lermer, I think the way that this amendment is worded is that it is I'm assuming the employer will probably put a notification either with a job posting or with the applications to say, if you have these kinds of convictions in your record, you may or may not qualify for this position. You may not qualify for this specific position. So I think it would be specifying certain types of criminal convictions.
Okay.
Any other questions on the amendment to the amendment? On Senator Olson's amendment to the amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now on the A3 amendment, Senator Scheid's A3 amendment as amended. Any further discussions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Could an employer make reference to the entire Chapter 609, the criminal code of the state of Minnesota, and just leave it at that? Is that particular enough?
Senator Limmer, I think that the reason why I like particular is that we want to make sure that we are taking into consideration, I guess, the specific job. Otherwise, every job that you have posted, you can just list the chapter, and it's not really informative to the applicants.
Yeah, I'm raising these questions because I know someone in the near future will ask. Mm-hmm. And it's important for us to leave some type of fingerprints on the record as we do this. And since there's no direction or guiding path to the employer that's going to have to deal with this policy, we probably should have a discussion of how broadly a statement can they make, or how particular or specific do they need to get in isolating that narrow interest of law that would disqualify someone from employment.
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I think it's important to make it, to have it narrowed so that we are talking about a specific background. I'm thinking of someone who might want to become a school bus driver for a school district if they're the employer. This would only apply to the public employer, I think, this bill. So a school bus driver with a drunk driving record, probably that might very well disqualify, or a sex offender at certain jobs. But I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't disqualify somebody from a custodian position. I don't know that. But I think if you're applying to be a driver, they can say a certain criminal background.
Mr. Carlson, you're at the table because you helped craft this amendment.
Chair, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. And, yes, I did work with Senator Latz and Ms.
Mr. Carlson, yes. Can you pull the microphone
sure.
closer to you? It's both for recording and for amplification.
I apologize, Madam Chair. I am Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Metropolitan or the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I did work with Senator Latz and Ms. Pontiance in crafting this amendment. The issue at hand, Senator Scheid's comments are right on point. There are at least 20 different statutes that deal with criminal background checks for various positions. And what constitutes a disqualifying crime for each one of those positions may vary. Consequently, the language that references a particular or a specific criminal history background is certainly germane for a specific position. So I definitely agree with the comments that Senator Scheid has made.
Senator Lemmer, thank you for asking the question. On the A3 amendment as amended, any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senate File 538 as amended. Any further discussions? Anybody in the audience who wish to testify against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Olson moves that Senate File 538 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Latt, Senate File 537.
Madam Chair, Senate File 537 is in some ways closely related to the amendment that was just adopted on the previous bill. This is a notice provision. It's a notice provision for people who are applying to higher education institutions and wish to go through a degree program so they can become employed in certain careers or fields or positions. What we have found, you will hear from Shante Holmes in a few moments, if I could ask her to join me at the witness table here, is that there are instances in which people will apply for and go through the educational process almost to the end or to the end, and then they find if they need licensing or if they need particular certifications or anything like that, that they are disqualified from getting the necessary certificates to work in the field, or that if the general practice for employers is not to hire people with certain kinds of criminal backgrounds in that field as well. So we felt it be appropriate to require that the higher ed institutions formally notify their applicants for position in their schools. that they may face this risk if they've got a background, and they should take a look into it up front instead of finding out by surprise later.
And Senator Latz, this bill has been to the Higher Ed Committee, and
yes,
it came to us with recommendations from the Higher Ed Committee.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Ms. Shante Holmes, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the community. I'm an individual that's made some mistakes in the past, and those mistakes led me to having a criminal background, which is why I feel that this topic is very urgent to me and very fond in my heart, because I was a person who's determined to move forward in my life. When I decided that I wanted to get my life together, I took the necessary steps. I went to treatment. I completed my probation. I did my jail sentence. I even moved into sober and transitional housing. And it was there and at that time that I decided that I deserved more and that there was more for me in my life, such as instead of being maybe a crackhead or a criminal at that particular time. So after a couple years into my sobriety, I decided that I wanted to reach further for higher goals. And one of those goals consisted of applying to Minneapolis Community Technical College. When I walked onto the campus, it was a very warm, friendly environment, and the counselors addressed me, the instructors addressed me, just as I was a normal student. No one there had any signs of indication saying, if you're a felon, please stand over here or wait in this line. None of that was presented to me. It's just an easygoing flow. So I continued to proceed on with my education, but now if I kind of step back a little bit, there wasn't an individual that approached me and asked me the question, but there was that FAFSA form, and that FAFSA form was the first piece of paper that indicated, have you been convicted of a crime? And at the time when I was in school, that was a question that at that time I had to be very hesitant, and I had to deny what my contributions to the question was at that time. So I denied it, and I went on to my second year denying that question as well. But all through college, I made it on the Dean's Honor Rolls list. I went to their beneficial breakfasts and brunches, and not even there did the dean come and shake my hand and say, hey, Shante, did you know your criminal background was going to hinder you from moving forward? No, what they said was continue on, good success, move on to Metro maybe, and, you know, furthering of encouragement words and stuff, nothing of the sort to realize what your mistakes can do to hinder you in the future. So it wasn't, though, until I got into my final semester, which is the term where you do an internship, which is very imperative to receiving your degree. Well, it was a class of, I would say, almost 25 peers, and it was myself and another one of my peers that supported information to the Department of Human Services, and that at that time came back to us, or to myself and the other individual, saying, remove her immediately. Now, that was a blow to my heart, and I really had the determination, but I was also very fearful of what my options was going to be as far as completing or getting my AS in human services at that time. So the instructor told everybody, all you have to do is go apply or interview with a couple other agencies, and you know, you'll score your job and you'll land an internship and complete it, and you can move forward to graduating. Well, for me, there was a barrier, and that dilemma happened that I had to interview with five agencies, and these are agencies that had the mission statement, we're here to support, uplift the individuals under poverty and individuals that are trying to retransition their lives back into society. And those places were places like PPL, Genesis 2, Anoka Mental Health, Social Services, Lutheran Social Services. And it wasn't until I went to Amicus, which is the Latin word for friends, which acknowledged the fact that even despite the mistake that you may have made, there is still an opportunity for you to reposition yourself back into society. So they welcomed me in as an intern, and it was there that I completed my internship. Thank God for that, because that, like I said, is a main criteria to getting your degree. And had it not been for them, I don't know where I'd have been today. In addition to those five stops that I made, I also had to go through an appeals process through a judge who, after 15 minutes of conversation, mentions to me, "Oh, there's nothing that we could do at this particular time to assist you." So it was up to me to put motivation and determination to it, to continuously search for a place that would allow me the opportunity. Now, as I today graduated with an AS in human services, I now work with the people who the Department of Human Services once said, "Remove her immediately." And I every day am dedicated and committed to these women, to helping them see that life can be better if you move and transition into a better lifestyle and believe in yourself. So I come here today to encourage you and to ask you to make the decision and to help individuals to want to change their lives.
Ms. Holmes, how long was your program?
It was a 2-year program through the Minneapolis Community Technical College.
And how much was the total in tuition that you paid to be in this program?
Oh, I would say each year probably ran maybe $7,000 to $9,000, depending on
what I needed.
But I also, through that process, I worked on campus, I studied, I tried to surround myself completely on campus just so that I could feel a part of it and get the encouragement that I needed as well. So,
thank you. Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I have a question. First of all, congratulations. And
thank you.
Good for you. Were you in trouble? Did they say to remove you because you had denied on the application? In other words, the language of the bill might have alerted you, you know, to check things out, or, you know, what is that, what caused you the trouble when they, you got to that last roadblock?
Absolutely.
Ms. Holmes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. What the bill specifies is if there's some form of notification, then the participant could actually navigate or plan their situation. Had I had known that I needed letters of recommendation, needed to be on the dean's list several times and stuff, I would have created a portfolio, which I did, but others can actually identify with what the process may consist of in order to actually be successful, and then make that concrete decision of whether or not this is feasible for me, or even opt out and go in a different direction. So,
thank you. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, what you're hearing today are the success stories. And what I'm afraid, and the purpose of the bill, is that there are many not-so-successful stories, those who don't have quite the determination or confidence to overcome the barriers. The idea is to remove some of the barriers, or at least to notify people that there are barriers ahead, and they can plan accordingly. Right. In Ms. Holmes' case, there was a route to get around the barriers, but in some cases, there may be an absolute statutory prohibition on someone who has a particular conviction from working in a particular field. And can you imagine the devastation, not to mention the cost, of getting to the last semester of school and finding no judge really can get you around that barrier, and no amount of determination is going to accomplish that for you. You're stuck without any options, and then you have to go back to square one. And what a tremendous waste of not only personal resources, but if taxpayer dollars are paying for tuition, what a tremendous waste of taxpayer dollars as well.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Anybody else here who would like to testify against this bill? Any further discussions on Senate File 537?
Madam Chair, I know you want to move. I just want to say that when I first saw this, I was reminded of our conversation. I think it was in this committee where we talked about, I think we were actually over in room 10 when we talked about teenagers. And I realize this is dealing with people going on to post-secondary, but they're probably we should use it as a model of something we might share with young people, particularly those who are into the sexting or you know, other kinds of activities. They have no clue about how it could follow them the rest of their lives. So I'd like to move the bill.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the only comment I wanted to make is that this bill doesn't seem to place any responsibility other than giving the notice on the department in terms of having this, or the educational institution in terms of having this information available. And I'm sure if we did that, we'd get a fiscal note, and, you know, that might impede the chances of the bill. So I'd just like to say for the record, though, that I would encourage and hope that educational institutions would have that kind of information available and would help students figure this out, because I would hate to see this notice discourage someone from pursuing a career. We definitely don't want them pursuing the wrong career and wasting money, and I know that's Senator Latz's intent. We don't want people giving up either. So hopefully we'll make try to help students get this information.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, as I'm looking over the statement, I was just wondering, is there any liability in the event that the institution fails to make this notice of any kind? If someone went forward, invested all this money in their education, and then realized that perhaps something in their past might have triggered an unintended consequence, or do we blame the institution? Do we hold the institution liable? Was it placed in a highly recognized place where the likely person could see this statement in a document? Is it signed? I'm just wondering. I don't really want to trigger a liability on the part of the institution, but I also want to make sure that the student would actually see it and read it, perhaps sign off on it on a document that's presented to them when they file for student enrollment. Something like that, they would have a more positive recognition that they've seen it and read it.
Senator Latz, any thoughts?
Madam Chair, I don't know that I can speak to the liability issue, but I would expect that it would be a good practice for each institution to put this notice in their application, and perhaps even to have a separate signature line acknowledging that the student has received and read the notice. That would be good practice. I'd be a little hesitant, I think, to mandate that particular logistics. That might be going a little bit too far. But, you know, every educational institution has lawyers that advise it, and I'm sure their lawyers would give them good advice on how to make sure the notice is received.
Okay. I'm sure I may.
Senator Lemmer?
I might attempt to work with Senator Latz. Maybe we could come up with something before it gets to the Senate floor.
Yes.
And I think it would be very nice to have bipartisan support on this bill.
I would be happy to work
yes.
with Senator Lemmer.
I always strive for that, Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer, that's the pride of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator Scheid renews her motion that Senate File 537 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you,
thank you, Ms. Holmes. Thank you, Senator Latz. Senator Moore, are you beginning with Senate File 564?
Madam Chair, I'd like to start with Senate File 763.
On 763, then.
Madam Chair and members, Senate Files 564 and 763 have been through the subcommittee as well as the full committee of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee.
And they sent it to the Senate Judiciary Committee with recommendations. I'd like to start with Senate File 763. I have with me today two individuals, Mr. Andre Corbett, who is with the Goodwill Easter Seals, and Professor Chris Eugen from the University of Minnesota. He's a professor of sociology. They both gave extensive testimony in the other committees. And if you have questions, I would like them to be able to answer questions. As you ask me questions, if I feel that they have information that was given in the other committees that would be useful, I will ask them to respond to those questions. But because of the number of bills we have on the agenda today, I will just present the bills and then leave it for your consideration. Senate File 763, Madam Chair and members, is a bill relating to notification to individuals who have served their time and have been, I guess the technical term is been off papers, to give them sufficient notification that they are now eligible to vote. Historically, I think that it's been a little bit difficult for individuals who have been convicted of a felony in this state to be fully informed that once they are off papers that they're now eligible to vote. So Senate File 763 takes current law as it is and builds into that a couple of notification requirements. One piece of the I'm trying to get to my summary here so that I can tell you where it is. So the bill asks that am I presenting the right one here? Let's see, 763. Yeah, that's just the notice requirement one. The bill basically asks that upon a person's discharge, both from the correction facilities and upon their discharge from probation or parole, that they will be given a notice that their civil rights or their right to vote has been restored. And the language of that notice is on page 3 of the bill. And then at the back of the bill, we ask that during the plea process, if an individual is going to go through the plea process, that they be given the notice or they be informed that by agreeing to a plea with respect to a felony conviction, that they may be, that one of the collateral consequences of that is the loss of their right to vote. And that's really the gist of the bill. The rest of the bill on page 4, the duties of the Secretary of State, basically changes, asks for the Secretary of State to work with judges, to work with probation officers and correction officers to ensure that this new notification provision is adequately provided to individuals who are discharged from probation, parole, or discharged from our corrections facilities.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pariseau.
My 763 is only one sheet, 2 pages.
Senator Moy, we were just noticing that, too, as we were looking at that. I think you're working off of a different...
First English.
You're working off the...
The original, maybe?
Can't find another page.
You know, I'm really sorry. You know, I was looking at the heading on my my sheet here, and that's why I'm all confused.
We'll get you a new... File 763 is a 2-page bill that has to do with the notices. I think it's just on front and back.
Okay.
So were you giving us a description?
I was giving you the description of 763.
That's what I thought.
Yep. So I was giving you a description of 763. Mm-hmm. So the Secretary of State information is in Section 1. Section 2 is the notice notification that I talked about. And then Section 3 of the bill is the informed plea section of the bill. So it takes current law as it is, and it just puts in a new notice provision.
Thank you, Senator Moy. And do you want to have your witnesses testify, or are they just here for questions?
No, I mean, they'll answer questions on both bills, unless committee members have other questions they'd like to ask.
Do the members have any questions for Senator Moir, her witnesses? Senator Moir, I have a question. I think you said this doesn't change anything substantive about the law related to restoration of civil rights, except for just providing a notice so to make sure people understand that this is that they've been restored. But the question I had is, are there some civil rights that are not restored upon discharge? I mean, I thought there were perhaps some limitations on people's civil rights after discharge, like gun ownership, for example. And so I'm just wondering, I mean, it's not that your bill directly addresses that point, but I just wonder if the notice should make it clear that there are going to be some limitations if, in fact, they do exist, rather than just saying your civil rights are restored.
Madam Chair, Senate File 763 does not restore civil rights upon discharge. Senate File 763 is current law that says that you cannot vote until you are currently off, you are all done. You're discharged and you're off papers, so you're done with probation and parole. That's what current law says. And so Senate File 763 says, given what current law is or does, there is a problem that sometimes individuals who have gone through the whole process, have been incarcerated, discharged, gone through probation, parole, oftentimes don't have adequate notice that their right to vote has been restored. So for your purposes, I think to answer your question, I would have you look at the notice language, which says that your civil rights have been restored, and this is your right to vote in Minnesota. But I think that this doesn't mean that if you go through if you want to own a gun, you have to go through the background check. This doesn't undo any of the other things that are currently in the law.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Schein.
Madam Chair, could we just maybe deal with just some grammar?
It's the other Linda saying that.
Well, I've always said, Madam Chair, that English is my second language, so
no, and oh, my goodness.
I would invite you to help with grammar.
Senator Schein, do you have
Madam
an
Chair,
amendment
Madam
off?
Chair, I would start on with the first three lines of the bill, line 7 through 9 on page 1. Instead of saying, where you're saying people who have been charged with or convicted of a crime in a single publication, I think we could put in a single publication after information on line 1. Is that?
Okay, so Senator Schein, I understand from that, I agree with that from a grammatical sense. Do you have any objection to that, Senator Moir?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, then I think Senator Scheid moves.
She has a few more.
Oh, you have more? Do you want to put them all together?
I think so, unless we run into one that you don't like. But on line 9, put electronically after available instead of before it. Publication must be made available electronically. And on line 11, take out the first and.
Comma.
And insert a comma. So for distribution to correction officials, comma, parole officers, and to the public.
So Senator Scheid moves.
Oh, actually,
I actually have a...
Take the two out.
And then I have a couple others. On line 12, take out the word to. Should we just do page 2 separately, or do you want to just keep going?
Maybe we should make that one motion at this point, just so there's no confusion. So Senator Scheid moves that on line 1.7, after information, insert in a single publication, and on line 1.8, put a period after crime and delete the rest of that sentence. Then further on line 1.9, delete the word electronically, and then insert the word electronically after the word available. On line 1.11, delete the first and insert a comma after the word officials. And on line 1.12, insert the word to.
Strike
the word to. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Then, Madam Chair, on the second page, and I don't know if Senator Higgins would agree with me or not, but I, on line 11 where it says your final discharge today means that your civil rights have been automatically restored, I would put automatically at the end of the sentence. Your civil rights have been restored automatically. And then on line, that would be on line 11 and 12. Mm-hmm. Then on line 15, just put also in front of can. So where you see can also, just put also can. And I think
Senator
that Scheid,
what line was that on?
That's line 15, 215.
Okay.
Just changing the order of those two words. And I think that's all. I don't know why, but I think it's just more straightforward.
Okay.
Madam Chair, in consultation with the professor, we would be okay if Senator Scheid wants to just delete automatically.
Madam Chair, I would prefer to do that. Thank you. Okay. Really, I was almost going to say, you really don't need that.
So Senator Scheid moves it on line 2.11, delete the word automatically, and on line 2.15, where it says also register, reverse those two words.
Can also.
Oh, excuse me. Can also revert, so it should read also can. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion? Is there anyone here who wanted to testify about this bill? Senator Moore, are you ready to move your bill?
Madam Chair and members, thank you. I'd like to move that Senate File 763 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay, now to the bigger bill, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I guess Finance has requested that they see this bill, so I guess we need a motion to recall.
Madam Chair, I was under the impression that the only file that had finance implications was Senate File 564.
Mr. Backus, do you have some information about that?
Madam Chair, I had gotten an email earlier. Perhaps it's been superseded, but I would defer to the author then.
Well, Senator Moore, it's your call. So.
I guess I'm a little bit confused. If corrections is here, maybe, or whoever is asking for that, I'd like a clarification. My understanding was that 763 wasn't asking for anything extraordinary other than the notification being a part of the regular discharge, regular probation process. And that 564 is what was going to incur the extra reporting that might incur a fiscal note.
Well, Senator Ma, could I suggest then that we leave it the way it is for now, and then we can check on this and bring it back if we need to before the end of the hearing? But, or whatever you would prefer to do, if you're not. We'll leave it. So on file. Five 564, is that the next bill you'd like to present?
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 564 is a little bit more extensive. And it goes a little bit further than 763. 564 really does three main things. It restores the voting rights to people convicted of a felony at the point they are released from incarceration or placed on probation or parole instead of the end of the felony sentence. And that's in sections 2 to the 6. And then the second thing it does is that it requires the same notice that we saw in 763, about voting rights to be provided at the time of the sentencing for a felony and when a person's voting rights are restored. And then the third thing is that it requires or asks the Secretary of State to publicize information about these changes, again, to judges, corrections officials, elected officials, and the public. So the different sections of the bills, many of them are technical. Section 1 of the bill makes a technical change, the wording change the wording of who is not eligible to vote. Section 2 changes the definition of restoration of civil rights. Section 3 requires the correctional facilities to designate a person to provide the notice. I could take it section by section, but I think that the bill, as it goes through, really does the three things that I provided. And as you look at that, I'd be glad to answer questions. But the gist of it is that we are restoring people's rights to vote at the point when they're discharged from a corrections facility or discharged from a county jail as they are as sentenced according to the felony sentence. People who are wouldn't be eligible would be people who are either on work release currently sentenced for that felony conviction to a county jail, or people who are incarcerated in the corrections facilities. And then the notice provision in here, we're asking that probation officers help provide the notice to catch the ones who are currently on probation or parole. So that we have, at the point of discharge, the provision of the information, and then the probation officers and are also providing the notice so that we're catching all the people who are currently on probation parole in addition to the upcoming individuals who are going to be discharged from incarceration. And that's the bill.
Thank you. Senator Mwah, do you have testifiers? Or?
I think maybe I'll have the professor speak about this bill. In particular, I think that he has some information about sort of the national scene, how many other states have come in this direction that might be helpful to committee members.
Welcome to the Judiciary Committee. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Hugan. I'm a professor and chair of the University of Minnesota Department of Sociology. And I've written several articles in a book on felon disenfranchisement. Minnesota currently disenfranchises current prison inmates, probationers, and parolees, as we've discussed. Disenfranchisement has risen dramatically in Minnesota from about 9,000 people in the mid-1970s up to about 25,000 in 1990 to currently about 70,000 Minnesotans are affected. And only about one in four of those individuals is currently incarcerated. And as I've shared some of these materials with you, now this is partly a reflection of our very efficient Department of Corrections and Justice system that we make extensive use of probation and parole in Minnesota, far more than other states. But it does create a paradox in that people who are sentenced to long probation terms will often be disenfranchised far longer than those who are sentenced to prison because they might get a 10-year probation term and only 2 years incarcerated. So this creates a condition in which people are disenfranchised for quite some time. And disenfranchisement currently falls disproportionately on communities of color. Currently, about 10% of African-American voters are disenfranchised in this state. The bill under consideration would reduce that to about 3.5% to 4% disenfranchised. It's also the case that nationally, the general public supports reenfranchising probationers and parolees. About 68% in a recent Harris poll supported reenfranchising probationers, about 60% parolees. But that public support for restoring voting rights stops at the prison gate, so only about 30% favored restoring the right to vote for prisoners. One project that I have underway in the state of Oregon is actually examining voting and recidivism. So we're looking at whether probationers and parolees who are permitted to vote in that state are indeed more or less likely to get into subsequent trouble. And it's clearly the case that those who vote are significantly less likely to reoffend and end up in a return to prison. This idea of restoring voting rights to probationers and parolees is generally consistent with the logic of probation and parole, which suggests that maintaining your bonds to work, to family, as a stakeholder in your community is consistent with successful reintegration. There are currently quite a range of state practices on this issue. States such as Maine and Vermont permit even prisoners to vote. A large number disenfranchise inmates only. In states like Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio all permit probationers and parolees to vote. So in conclusion, I'll just sum up. This bill, in my view, would expand democracy, reduce racial disparities. It may improve public safety, and it would be largely consistent with the practices of our neighbors. Thank you.
Madam
Thank
Chair.
Thank you, Professor. Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Professor Ugin. What is the rationale for having any kind of a restriction on the ability to vote?
Professor Ugin?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, disenfranchisement is an ancient practice, and it's tied to a notion of banishment by which one offends against the state or the king and is thus cast out of the polity for some period. The United States is alone in disenfranchising so many of its citizens. In many nations, only those convicted of political crimes are disenfranchised. So illegally voting or making illegal campaign contributions, et cetera. In Minnesota, in the United States, I should say, the practice has been extended far more broadly to infamous crimes in some states, and which has largely been interpreted as all felonies.
Senator Foley?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Mall, I kind of think you ought to delete the word deal with the voters and any restriction thereon.
Senator Foley, I'm sorry, I'm not focusing. Where would you like me to delete what?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Well, I thought in the interest of fairness that there shouldn't be any restrictions, period.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, you want to go a lot further
yes.
than I have in this bill. I'm glad to know there's one vote on the committee for at least this bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, instead of going through each detailed thing, I've spoken to Mr. Backus, so he sought me out and pointed out that some of this language is identical to the language of the of 763 and of Senate File 763. So I think if I just make a general motion to adopt the same language changes, because it's in the same places. It would be the same sections. And then I would just point something out to members on page 3, that this bill on line 15 includes supervised release agents, and that's probably fine. The other bill doesn't have that phrase in there. It just says parole, corrections officials, parole, and the public. So just pointing out, if you want to fix the other one, not right now probably, but I am guessing you probably want what's on line 15 of this bill of 564. So, Madam Chair, may I make that kind of a motion? That doesn't involve a change.
Sure.
That Senator, last thing I mentioned.
Senator Scheid moves that we give counsel the authority to make grammatical changes consistent with the changes we made to Senate File 763 on that motion.
I'm fine, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is that? Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Moi or Professor Yugen, when you were doing your this reference of a study regarding voting and recidivism, is that a completed study now?
That's
Professor
right.
Yugen?
Oh, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, yes, that's correct. I've completed a study in Minnesota using Minnesota data as well for those who are formerly released from incarceration who are now eligible to vote, and replicated these results there as well. This particular study has been presented at the American Society of Criminology meetings.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer?
Professor. Prior to incarceration, were these individuals, did they have a history of voting while they were criminalizing the public?
Professor Yugen?
Madam Chair and Senator, many were too young to vote because they often become enter the system at early ages, prior to 18. The rates of participation ranged between 10% or so for the parole sample up to about 20% for the probation sample once they were eligible in Oregon. Typically, those who are disenfranchised are participating at rates about half of those in the general population when they are able to vote. So it's quite likely the case. The turnout rates are lower, but indeed they do participate.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you. Senator Moi, do you know if there was any participation in support of your bill from prosecutors? Did they weigh in on your bill?
Senator Moi?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, the bill is Senate File 564. I can't remember the exact date when it was introduced, but it's gone through. This is the third committee, really, hearing that we've gone through. No prosecutors have really contacted me. I've worked with the Secretary of State's office on both bills, with corrections, with the probation officers, and throughout the committees, and really haven't been contacted by prosecutors. But on your question, you know, Senator Limmer, Mr. Corbett is here, and he's given some testimony of his own personal experience with the right to vote and all the other two committees. And I thought maybe he could share his experience to give you an illustration of somebody who actually went through the whole process and earned the right, had his right to vote restored back to him and having voted for the first time.
Mr. Corbett, welcome to the committee. Would you
thank
state
you,
your
Madam
name
Chair.
For the record?
Andre Corbett. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. When I was younger, 20 years old, I got into actually a whole lot of trouble, which I ended up incarcerated for a point in time of 3.5 years. While I was incarcerated, I really took a look at my life and took advantage of the different programs that were offered in prison, including completing 32 college credits while incarcerated, participating in the Alternatives to Violence Project, and realizing that my life outside of prison actually began when I got to prison. When I got out, I got involved in a lot of training programs, and I've been a huge advocate of ex-offender rights. But the right to vote particularly hit me really hard when I got off parole in August of this past year, and I got a letter in the mail stating that all of my civil rights, including the right to vote, was restored. I never knew at the point in time when I went to trial and lost that none of my civil rights would be taken away. It was never informed of me to me that I had to wait until I got off parole to vote. But I remember when I filled out the voter registration card, I already had it filled out sitting at my office desk for the day after I got off parole. And I sent it in the mail. And I remember I voted in the primaries, but it really didn't hit home till I voted in the main election. When I went to the voter, the place to vote, just seeing the people in line, it really brought a sense of community to my own self. And I think this bill is a small piece of the whole pie for people who are really serious about making a whole life turn around. I remember leaving the place and driving back to work and coming past Concordia College. And it was a spirit of that whole election process of college kids that was running around with their chests painted in support of their candidate. And before, I never voted before, but it was that sense of community, of everybody honking horns and signs, and that made me feel really a part of the community. And I remember being younger and doing a Pledge of Allegiance, which says liberty and justice for all, and assuming that the right to vote was guaranteed to every American citizen despite having been incarcerated or for other reasons. And that's why I really support this bill, and also representing Goodwill Easter Seals, which is an organization in support of this bill. And I work directly with ex-offenders, and I always encourage them to get involved in the political process, that even though they can't vote, call your senators, call people, come down to the Capitol. But the consistent thing that I hear from them is that I can't vote, so why should I even come down, or why should I write a letter, or why should I call? And also realizing that we all have kids, family members, wives, husbands, cousins, who are in our community, and our voice really should matter. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, I wish you had been there when we had this bill before the election subcommittee. Mr. Corbett took his two goddaughters out of school to come be with us during that testimony, and the grin on their faces as he was testifying was just amazing. And I think that he makes a very compelling case for us trying to do something about this in this area.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, on Election Day last year, I had, it was a pretty cool place in my district. Election Day was a lot of fun there. And in the afternoon, my husband and I went out to knock on some doors to make sure that everybody had gone out to vote. And there, as we were going to the car, a couple of gentlemen were coming the other way, and I didn't see the little I voted stickers. And so I said, "So, you been to vote today?" And they said, "No, we can't vote." And I said, "Oh, are you off paper?" "Oh, yeah, we've been off paper for years." And I said, "You've been able to vote for years." And they said, "Well, no, ma'am, we're felons. We can't vote." And I said, "Well, hi, I'm the state senator. I know this stuff. Go vote." And it was a really fun conversation to be able to tell somebody that they could participate in that very cool thing that was happening that day called an election. And my husband and I have talked about it several times, and how much we were glad we were able to help two people who didn't know that they could go vote, be able to vote that day. It was really, it was really powerful for us.
And Madam Chair, let the record reflect that I don't think Senator Higgins was on the ballot that day.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Senator Schein.
Madam Chair, Mr. Corbett, Your testimony reminds me of a wonderful, inspiring speech that the late Senator Alan Speer gave, talking about how thrilling it was to, and what it meant to him to stand in line on Election Day. I think we were talking about voting by mail, and he wasn't in favor of that. But your statement took me back to remembering that and thinking about that myself and how cool that is. So. Mm. Thank you for sharing that.
And Senator Mwan, first, I would just like to say, too, that I think we really all appreciate Mr. Corbett's testimony and congratulate him on not just the fact that he's concerned about the right to vote, but that he was able to turn his life around and just obviously is a great success story. And I wholeheartedly supported your earlier bill, Senator Moi, because I think everyone should have notice of the right to vote when they have earned that right. Some of us might feel it's not a right that needs to be earned back after committing a crime, and some of us might disagree. So I guess we all kind of might have different feelings, or some of us might have different feelings about where that line should be drawn. But that doesn't take anything away from the pride we all feel in your accomplishment, sir. So are you ready to move your bill? Are there any other questions or discussion?
Madam Chair and members, with full disclosure, we have been in discussions with the Department of Corrections, and there are some concerns that this there might be the reporting requirements might or may trigger some fiscal impact. And so I would move that Senate File 564 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Mwan, and I guess I neglected to ask if there was anyone else in the audience that was here to testify on the bill. Is there anyone else here to testify? So then on that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good stuff.
These two have been working really hard on these bills. Madam Chair, I'd like to take up Senate File
562.
And I believe there are a couple of amendments.
Two of them.
Madam Chair, I'd like to, I think there's an A1 and A3 amendment in your file, and I'd like to do the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment is the right amendment. I'd like to offer that as the author's amendment.
Senator Moi moves the A3 amendment to put the bill in the shape she'd like to have it considered. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
And I'm aware of one other amendment, but we'll discuss the bill and then we can consider the other amendment, Senator Scheid. Madam Chair, remember, you have a document in your packet of information from the Council on Crime and Justice. And Mr. Hasse is here to help me talk a little bit about this bill. I think this bill has been through this committee once before. And in its last incarnation, we were trying to give some protection to private employers who would take into consideration barring those who are statutorily required to do a background check and to not allow people to work for them, whether that's employers or all the whole host of other statutory people who are required to do statutory background checks. There are a certain category of private employers who are not required to do all kinds of statutory background checks. And they would like to have the ability to consider somebody who might have criminal history as employees. And what this bill is trying to do is to create to give these private employers an opportunity and to clarify and limit their liability for hiring somebody with a criminal record. So I would invite Mr. Hasse to give some testimony on this bill, and then I will take some questions.
Welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Hasse, and I am the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy at the Council on Crime and Justice. One of my roles at the council, when I'm not here hanging outside of your office, I've been working on a program, or the council, I should say, has been working on a program for the last 2 years called GAGE. GAGE stands for Gaining Access to Useful and Gainful Employment. And the goal of that program is that the goal is to try to get employers to understand criminal records and criminal record liability and a number of other issues better so that they can make good decisions about hiring people with criminal records and also open up more opportunities to people with records. I've been working with the program for a year, and in developing the curriculum for the training that we do, we met with employers, we met with people who place individuals with records with employers. We've worked closely with some employment law attorneys at some of the large law firms in the cities. And what we've done is come up with hiring practices that we recommend. And let me just say that one thing I really like about this approach to our work at the council is that, you know, no disrespect intended, but you all can pass laws at law after law, and then the next question is, are people going to follow it, right? And I think, you know, as Judge Alexander said, some states have prohibitions on what employers can do around hiring people with a record. Minnesota doesn't have any. But even in those states where employers, for instance, can't discriminate based on a record that's greater than 7 years old, they still do. That research has shown that. And what I like about this approach is that if we want the practices of employers to change, we have to get employers on board, make it in their best, tell them why it's in their best interest to open up opportunities, but also help them help them so that they don't have to worry about the liability so much. And I will say this, it was last year that this bill came before you in a different version, and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce was here testifying against it. I don't think they're going to be here today because we've worked closely with them. And the last amendment was drafted basically in cooperation with their employment law attorney. Because we want something here that's going to actually help employers and the business community. Let me just give you a little bit of background on employment or negligent hiring liability. Minnesota is, let me back up a little bit. One of the things we've come up against in training employers and how to hire people with records is that risk assessment. The employment law attorneys that we've spoken to say, well, when we advise our clients, a lawyer's job is to minimize risk for your client, right? Well, in Minnesota, the risk associated with hiring somebody with a criminal record and not hiring somebody with a criminal record is very low to little. The potential risk, just because Minnesota is one of 36 states that recognizes negligent hiring liability, and although the liability is fairly narrow, just because it's there, there's a little higher risk. And so when they do that assessment, well, the easy answer is if they have a record, don't hire them because you can't get into trouble there, but it's possible you can get in trouble if you do hire them. So this bill, as Senator Moss said, is intended to, one, clarify the liability a little bit, because the only way to learn about it now, we have a 10-page legal memo that describes it, but the only way to really learn what the liability is to dig into the case law. So especially paragraph A tries to clarify, and the other paragraphs help with some other records issues. And do you want me to go into those specifics of it, Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, members, if you have questions in that area, I think Mr. Hasse can certainly go into the specifics. But I think the bill is pretty self-explanatory on its face.
I guess that's all I have for general comments, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Members? Senator Moore, I have one question, or perhaps Mr. Hasse could answer it. It sounds like this only applies to situations where the record before the occurrence of the act giving rise to the civil action, where the record was sealed or the person received a pardon. So I'm assuming, would that be like an expungement situations or pardon situations?
Madam Chair, that is correct. And the intent of that particular paragraph, you may have heard in other hearings throughout the years that one of the issues with record sealing or expungement, well, there's a couple issues. One is they may still show up on commercial databases. The other is, under current case law, the judge may only seal the judicial branch record, and they may decide they can't seal the executive branch record. What this does is if somebody does get an expungement, they can take that to somebody who's hiring them, and then that employer knows that because that record's been expunged, that can't be entered into evidence in an action against them.
But Senator Moore, Mr. Hasse, I guess the answer to my question, though, I'm noticing that on line 1.14 there's an or. So it looks like you couldn't use this. I mean, they would be exempt from liability if any one of these three situations applied. Would that be accurate? It's not all of them. It's any one of them, right?
That's correct. It is an or.
Do the members have any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Sorry.
It's me.
Senator
Scheid. I'm so sorry.
I thought you were pointing. Senator Scheid?
I need to learn to speak up. I have an amendment, but are we at that point? And I'm offering the amendment. I'm not that well versed in it. I see Mr. Holton is in the audience. Are we at that point?
Madam Chair, or Senator Moore, I'm thinking maybe we should take any other testimony if we have anyone else here to testify on this bill first. Maybe would that clarify your amendment, Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, no, it's separate. It's for for a different chapter. So, well, I haven't even spoken with Senator Moore about it, except we got it to her as soon as we had it, I think.
Senator Moore, do you have any other witnesses to testify?
Madam Chair and members, I don't. I'm not aware of anybody who is going to be testifying in opposition to the bill.
Okay. Is there anyone else here to testify on this bill? Okay, then, Senator Scheid, why don't we take up your amendment?
And, Madam Chair, yes, and I would offer the A4 amendment, and I don't think it does damage to the body of the bill or to what Senator Moore was trying to accomplish here, but it has to do, you'll see it's regarding Section 240.08, that's the paramutual horse racing chapter in state statute, and Mr. Holton would... looks like he's willing to come up and speak to it.
Mr. Holton, would you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Court Holton, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota HBPA, which is a confusing title for the organization that represents people that race at horses at Canterbury Downs. What the amendment would do is presently... the law on occupational licensing. On a racetrack, everybody has to have a license to be on the grounds, whether you sell popcorn or whether you own the track. And there's a whole raft of different occupational licenses. This every one of those, the way the law is right now, if you have ever had a felony conviction of any kind, no matter what kind, no matter how young you were, no matter how many years ago it was, you cannot be licensed for any purpose. We have what we call backside workers, and these people typically travel from state to state with what we call the stable. And the stable is a trainer that has the horses that owners own, and he trains for these owners and he races their horses at racetracks. Racing is seasonal. You move around the country at different levels of quality depending on how high quality your stable is. Minnesota is one of those places. The backside workers are the guys and women that do a lot of, shall we say, shovel work. They haul hay. They work out the horses, they clean up the stalls, they cool down the horses, they lead the horses over to the paddock, they bring them back after the race, they feed them, they hose them down, they wash them. These are the human beings that these animals most closely associated with. It's a whole different world, and it attracts a certain type of people. And a lot of these people have had checkered pasts when they were younger and been in trouble and found out that the real world wasn't really a great place for them, but they do wonderfully working with animals in this secluded environment that we call the backside of a racetrack. It's something that you should all see one day since we have it right here. It is an entire different world. But you move from one state, then you move to Minnesota with the stable and the owner of the trainers, and Minnesota, you know, when you were 18, you had a felony check violation. You can't come to Minnesota, and I have to let you go, and then I'm going to replace you with somebody else. And so when I move next to Kentucky in the fall, somebody's got your job. And for these people, these jobs are very important, and this was very carefully structured. You have to be 10 years removed. You have to be off paper. You have to be 5 years off of discharge. You can only get licensed for certain jobs on the racetrack that do not involve security, surveillance, any of the things that you might be worried about. These are backside jobs. And you cannot even have a charge pending. Then there's certain felonies that will still be a lifetime disqualification. If you can meet all those requirements, you can haul hay bales on the backside of the racetrack. And that we have passed this once before. This legislature has passed this once before. The governor vetoed it because there was a reference to parole in there. And the veto message says we don't have parole in Minnesota anymore. I'm quite aware of that because I wrote the law that changed that so many years ago. But there's 49 other states, and several of them do have parole, and these people move from state to state. So I made a change there that took care of that. And the other thing was he thought that these people might be in security and surveillance and that, so we made it. That was never going to happen, but we made it clear that cannot happen under this bill. The employers need these people. These people need these jobs. And, you know, back there on the backside, they're really not a threat to anybody, and they're not a threat even if they were walking around the halls of this building. So I would appreciate your indulgence on this, and I'd be happy to respond to anything.
Madam Chair,
Senator
Schide.
Obviously, Senator Walker.
Senator, how do you feel about the amendment?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins had talked to me about this. Senator Schide, I think, talked to me briefly and went ahead and had it drafted into amendment. I think that I asked for this to be dropped in as a bill. I think is it a bill? Yeah, right. Senator Higgins, is this your bill?
Senator, I believe it's the Senator Metzen bill.
Okay, so the amendment is a bill, but if it's appropriate for this bill, and I think it is, I don't have any objections.
Senator Higgins?
And Madam Chair, I think Mr. Holton said it well. These are folks who are cleaning out the barns, hauling the hay bales, generally, you know, working in the backstretch, in the barns, in the areas far away from the gambling, and it just seems logical to me that if they can fit the qualifications that are narrowly drafted in this bill, that it's a good place to give them a chance to do good work.
And then, Madam Chair.
Senator Schein.
Madam Chair, I have a question perhaps for Mr. Holton. I don't know if you have the language of the amendment there on line 1.9, where it says, if the applicant has not been convicted of a felony or a crime involving fraud or misrepresentation within 10 years, is it any felony or is it a felony involving fraud and misrepresentation? I just wasn't sure.
Mr. Hazy? Holton.
Madam Chairman, Senator, it is this would be for 10 years. It is any felony, and in addition to that, if it's like a gross misdemeanor or something less than a felony, if it involves fraud, for instance, then that still is a disqualifier, even though it's not a felony. Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you. I didn't know if it was any felony or just one involved.
I might add that the lottery standard is 5 years for working for the lottery.
Madam Chair, my staff did reference something, and now I recall why I was a little bit hesitant when Senator Higgins and I talked about this amendment. I don't know, but I wonder if counsel could talk to us. If we put this amendment on the bill, I think the bill will have to go to state and local.
Ms. Pontius or Mr. Backus,
do you know?
Madam Chair, I mean, they would have to request it, but I believe this would be within their jurisdiction if they want to see it.
Madam Chair, I wonder if Mr. Holton or Senator Scheid, I don't think that Senator Metzen's bill is in this committee yet. It may be in state local. Mr. Holton, is that true, Senator Metzen's bill?
Mr. Holton.
Madam Chair, Senator, I assumed that it would be sent there because since it references 240, it would have the word gambling in the title and in the Senate and now in the House. To anything that says gambling in the title goes to a certain specific committee. This bill is all about employment, but I would assume that Senator Metzen's bill was sent to the government.
So, Madam Chair, I just have some concerns that with pending deadlines, I'm not sure. I mean, I like the amendment a lot, and so I'm kind of in a fix. I'm looking for direction from the committee.
Senator Scheid?
side, and then Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, on that, I don't know if it would have trouble in that committee because of this. I certainly wouldn't want that to happen to your bill. On the other hand, it might save time if this one had to go there rather than Senator Metzen's bill be heard there and then
come in here.
Probably come here. So it's kind of one hearing versus two, and I hate to do that to my chair.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Moore?
So if it's the committee's will, why don't we put the amendment on and we'll send it to them, and then we'll go beg them to give us a very quick hearing.
Senator Limmer, did you have a comment?
Yes. Senator Moore, maybe you could answer this question. If you've read the amendment, there's a great amount of reference to gaming operations, paramutual or card club revenues, gambling-related offenses. And I'm just wondering if this amendment is put on with this bill, could it become an instrument of further amendments for gambling-related bills, either on the Senate floor or in another committee? And I don't know if that's a concern for our committee to consider at this point, but if that did occur, what would be your intent on this bill in its entirety? Would you move it forward if there was a gambling provision on it?
Mr. Holton, or Senator Moy, I guess the question is to you.
Well, you know, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I appreciate your question. Obviously, no author ever want their bill to become a magnet for all kinds of amendments, and it certainly I would have some concerns if, you know, it is raised here. I think that once it hits the floor, any bill is sort of open to amendments. I guess we would have to take a look at it, whether or not it meets the Germanus test. And, well, Senator Limmer, I would think that you could be helpful in that analysis.
I'm sure I think he might have thought it over before he asked it.
Well, I just know how things
Senator
get...
Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just know how things work in the legislature, and I know that gambling is becoming more and more a discussion item in the legislature, and I would imagine that if this was attached, this might attract some expansive efforts by itself.
You know, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I mean, as I look at the language, I guess the words gaming are in there, but I don't think that a gambling bill would make the Germanus test. I mean, it wouldn't be germane. It would be substantially different from the underlying law, and it would be for whatever bill it is would have to be substantially related to the underlying bill. And in the what is the test? Substantially related to the intent of the bill as well as to the I guess it's operations, right, of the bill?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Moab,
Senator Limmer,
if I could reassert my question to you, if a major gambling provision was added to this bill, would you then table the bill or would you continue forward?
Well, Senator Limmer, I guess I would have to table the bill, but this is Mr. Holt's amendment. And Mr. Holtz would be one of the potential advocates that could put one of those amendments onto the bill. And so I would hope that in good faith, if I took this amendment on, that people would help us get this bill passed instead of putting other amendments onto the bill. But you never know, and I think that I agree with you that I would probably have to table my bill.
Mr. Holtz?
Madam Chair, Senators, what Senator Moore just said is if there's some kind of amendment, and I think I know the one that Senator Limmer is thinking of, there's a 99 out of 100 chance that I would be the culprit behind that, and that is not going to happen on this bill. I may make that attempt this year, but it will not be on anything that I have any of my own language on. So that you can take to the bank.
Okay. So are we ready to move this amendment? Is that your desire, Senator Moore?
Senator Scheid has moved the A4 amendment, I believe.
I did.
Senator Scheid has moved the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Moore, then, before we move your bill, I just want to say, I guess, you know, if we had an, I don't have a problem with the exemption from liability for records that have been sealed. In terms of arrests or charges that didn't result in a criminal conviction, I have a little problem with that because I think there are some situations where, you know, there's a technical reason why a person isn't convicted, but still a good reason why you wouldn't want someone working in a position where, you know, the common law that we have with regard to negligent hiring or negligent retention would make that person likely to be liable or responsible. And I have a real concern about the first provision because I guess there are some situations, I don't know what it means by being employed in general, but I understand and sympathize with the desire to want to have people be hired and not have the fear of liability prohibit employers from hiring people who've done things in the past that really aren't wrong. But I'm afraid that we're going to be changing the law or the standard regarding negligent hiring and retention if we do this and making them not responsible for situations where they otherwise would have been responsible under the law because they're hiring or retaining someone where there really is a threat of danger. And so I guess I'm just those are my concerns, and I just wanted to say that for the record. Any other discussion? Sarah Moore, are you ready then to refer? I guess this needs to go state and local, so are you ready to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Moore then moves Senate File 562 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to state and local government operations and oversight. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, why don't we have Senator Ortman present Senate File 645, and then we'll probably take a little bit of a break.
Senator Ortman, would you like to begin with Senate File 645?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing this bill. This bill has two major provisions to it. One addresses the mandatory minimum sentence for fifth-degree drug crimes, controlled substance crimes, and the other one relates to the conditional release program that we passed in, I believe it was 2005, members. If I could take you back, we had a joint hearing with the Public Safety Finance Committee a few weeks ago. And if you remember, there was a working group on controlled substances that met and made recommendations to the legislature regarding the way we sentence offenders for drug crimes. And there was a very extensive report given to you all. There was very impassioned testimony provided to the Joint Committee. The working group was quite extensive, and let me tell you that law enforcement was involved, the judiciary was represented, corrections was represented. Let me see if I get them all. Representatives from law enforcement, county attorneys, defense attorneys, corrections, courts, treatment professionals, sentencing experts, and community members. You can imagine they didn't all agree. And so with respect to the recommendations they made, many of the votes were 8 to 7, 7 to 8, 8 to 7, 7 to 8. Then we had the testimony in support of some provisions that were included in their report, and there was testimony about some of the provisions that were not included in their report. I would like to start, if we could, with the recommendations about the conditional release program. And we have a couple of handouts, I think, that that's being handed out now. It's the executive summary, which was part of the report to the legislature. So you'll have a little bit about the executive summary. And then you'll also have additional information from that report, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. At the hearing, we were given a little bit of information about our offenders in prison and in our jails. The Department of Corrections reported that they had 3,800 newly committed offenders and release violators that they assessed for chemical dependency abuse or dependency in fiscal year 2008. 90% of them, 90, were diagnosed as chemically abusive or dependent. 80% were directed to treatment. Members, 34% of offenders directed to treatment entered a program. In 2005, the legislature, 2005, we adopted the conditional release program. And if you remember, Senator Foley had a hearing about that, and I appreciated his leadership on that issue. And Senator Neville and I worked very hard together to make sure that we passed the conditional release program. You'll find in your materials it was because of a collaboration of many of the criminal justice related agencies and some of the professionals in that industry that met together, worked on this bill, and passed it. And one of the things I have in your packet is the bipartisan list of senators who supported that bill right from the get-go, and you'll find that almost every one of you is on there, and I appreciated your support from the very beginning. Now that program, the conditional release program, which allows drug offenders to shorten the length of their stay in prison if they are successfully rehabilitated in chemical dependency treatment programs in prison and then agree to reentry programs and intensive supervision on their way out and back into the community, that program is in jeopardy. It's in jeopardy tonight, members, and I'm going to ask you to support an expansion and extension of that program tonight, and it's in the bill that you have before you now. Just a little bit to go back to Senate to 2005, there was a poll that was conducted that was one of the reasons, I think, the bases upon which most of the legislature felt okay about making this change. At the time, it was rather controversial. I was told that it was soft on crime. And my argument was the proposal was smart on crime, and Minnesotans agreed. In the poll from 2005, 63% of Minnesotans believed that those convicted of drug possession should be directed towards treatment as opposed to incarceration. And you'll see that poll in your materials as well. So we passed the conditional release program, and then it was studied by the Council on Crime and Justice to see if it was effective. And you'll find in one of your additional handouts, you'll find the 2008 report to the legislature from the Department of Corrections. There were a couple of key findings in there that I'd like to point out for you that show the efficiency and the fact that we're getting to the actual cause of our problems here with this program. When they screened candidates that were qualified for this early release program, they screened 2,570 offenders. Only 49 made it through the screening process, mostly because they didn't qualify for the program because there was such a restriction and limitation on the types of crimes that we allowed folks to participate. So if they were convicted of something like a sale of drugs, they were not allowed to participate. If they were convicted of a non-drug offense but still had chemical dependency programs, they were not allowed to participate in this program. So of those 49 entered, of those 49, I think it was two percent was returned to prison for violating conditions of supervised release. None of the offenders, as of the date of the report, had to return to prison for a new offense. There was no recidivism, members, once our these folks actually succeeded through this program and were released. There was actually a prison bed savings. 5,427 days of prison bed space was saved through January 1, 2007. And there was also a fiscal savings. I know we'll talk more about that in Senator Higgins' committee, but actually $218,925 in savings once they factored in the cost of the intensive supervision of the program. So there is savings. I know we'll talk about that later. This report from the Council on Crime and Justice, which was adopted or approved by the working group, found that in order to be successful, this program needs to be expanded. We need to expand it to include all those folks that were screened out when we processed them the first time. Because they were screened out, they had some background in the sale of drugs, or they were there for non-drug offenses. The Department of Corrections actually made recommendations, and you'll see it on page 62 of the information that you were given, the DOC conclusions. I think this is really important. It said, if the program is going to be extended beyond the sunset date, the DOC believes the number of participants would need to increase in order for it to be a viable correctional program that reaches its anticipated cost reduction potential. So they're advising us to expand this program, members. And the way they said to do that was to add in these non-drug offenders, to use a level of service inventory revised, I didn't say that right, incorporated validated risk assessment tool that we do when folks are initially in their intake process, and use that chemical dependency assessment as a guide as opposed to the crime that they were convicted for as the primary guide for determining whether they should be considered for candidacy in a program like that. The bill that you have before you does that. It includes all of those recommendations from the Department of Corrections to expand the program. Members, I just want to point out, since this is the policy committee, why this makes good policy sense. If a Minnesotan is convicted of sale or possession of 10 grams of cocaine, the sentence under the sentencing guidelines would be 74 to 103 months, 6 to 15 years. And it really struck me when we passed this bill the first time that equates to the same sentence as someone who's convicted of third-degree murder, first-degree manslaughter, the same sentence. Folks that might be arrested and convicted of possessing 50 kilograms of marijuana, 50 kilograms, would be sentenced to 41 to 129 months, or 3.5 to 10 years. The same sentence as manslaughter, criminal vehicular homicide, and burglary with a weapon. For those folks that might be convicted of possession of 3 or more grams of cocaine, or 10 grams of marijuana, the sentence would be 34 to 68 months, or 3 years minimum to 5.5 years maximum under our sentencing guidelines. That's the equivalent sentence for someone convicted of second-degree aggravated robbery, kidnapping, and burglary. I think we have to have perspective here, and we have to allow a safety valve. Okay, we're going to convict these people. We understand that. We're going to sentence these people. But let's make sure that if they get the treatment and they present themselves as having been rehabilitated earlier than these sentencing guidelines, let's find a way to let them succeed outside of prison. Let's give them intensive supervision. Let's continue to monitor their chemical dependency. And let's help them with reentry programs. And that's what this conditional release program does. And when the Council on Crime and Justice reviewed the success of this program, they found it to be completely successful. Let me just point out one more thing that they found on page 61, a couple of different things that they found here. They found that 97% of all those who participated thought that it was a good program and was helpful. That's on page 60. They found on page 61, offenders at Lionel Lakes were required to write an 18-page reentry plan prior to their release, and they found that to be particularly helpful. The intensive supervised release was seen as a helpful component of the CRP by both participants and their social support. Participants and social support interviewees felt the program prepared participants well for release. And all the social support interviewees who knew other people who had been incarcerated felt that CRP participants were better equipped to transition smoothly into the community. This is the right program helping Minnesotans get back on their feet after a drug conviction. We can help these folks, and that's what this bill does. So I'm hoping that you will support the effort here to expand this program to allow more Minnesotans to qualify for this and to get the treatment that they need and to get back into society with that supervised release and the help we need to give them with reentry and restoration of their lives. I have with me members Dan Knuth and John Stewart. They're both here to testify in support of this bill. I will have a couple of amendments, but I would appreciate it, Madam Chair, if we could hear their testimony first and any others from the public here that might like to testify.
Mr. Stewart, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. I was a member of the working group that was referred to here that came and testified in January, and you're familiar with the report. I'm here largely to comment about Section 1, but I'd like to say two more things about the offenders that this would apply to, because I want to be sure people on the committee have an idea of what this would give these folks. These are people that before they would be eligible for this program, in addition to completing the treatment in the institution, they would have to serve half their sentence. As opposed to under the guidelines, if you serve two-thirds of your sentence, you can walk away with no treatment. So although you could say, let's take a person who's a second-degree controlled substance offender that gets a presumed sentence of 48 months. This person could do nothing to help themselves in prison, and they'd walk out at 32 months, and they'd be on what we most states call parole, but we call supervised release. They wouldn't have had to take a bit of treatment or anything, and at 32 months, they'd be out. Now, this bill is saying let them out at half the time, 24 months, provided they have completed the treatment, provided they're a nonviolent offender, provided they're going to comply with random drug testing, provided they're going to comply with electronic home monitoring, provided they're going to comply with other conditions set by the commissioner. So, to me, the 24-month person who has done all those things is more likely, as the recidivism figures show, that person is more likely to work out well in the community than the person from the same offense who did 32 months but did nothing to help himself. So I think this really is a good deal for people in Minnesota. I also would add one other thing. A lot of these offenders, depending on where they live, might have been eligible for drug court, and they wouldn't have even gone to prison in the first place. Minnesota, as you are all well aware, has 87 counties, but you only got 33 drug courts. So in 54 counties, there is no option for these people that are willing and able to turn things around by going to treatment to participate in a drug court. So, in a sense, this is a bill that begins to level the playing field a little bit for people who are willing to do something to help themselves. Would you like me to go ahead with Section 1 here a little bit, or you want to keep going about the rest of this?
Madam Chair, can we complete the testimony on this section of the bill and then move on to the other section? They're very different.
Whatever you would like, Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Dan Knuth. I represent the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. This is not an easy program to get into or out of, and if you're an offender. First, that you have to be serving a sentence that deals only with controlled substances. not primarily, not related to sale or profit. It also, you must serve at least half of your sentence plus up to or at least 36 months. That you have to successfully have completed a treatment program, and you have not been previously convicted or previously gone through this program. If you're back into prison, then you're no longer eligible for it. In the past, you could not have a be adjudicated for a violent crime in the last 10 years, or you're not eligible for it. The screening program that's done by the Department of Corrections is also very very strong program. You have to apply statutory mandated criteria that we just went through. That you they also deal with appropriate discretionary criteria. The prosecutors and the courts can weigh in on their recommendations to see if somebody is indeed eligible for it. They have to go through a behavior review through the screening process. You have to have a program review team work with you. The offender assigns an agreement to be involved with it. And finally, the commissioner approves those things before you're allowed to be part of that program.
May I interrupt for just a moment?
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, that contract part where the offender has to sign a contract, just, of course, that was Senator Neville's contribution. I'm sorry. Mr. Cruz, go ahead.
Senator Ortman, are we channeling Judge Neville again?
He wanted a contract on everything, I think.
Mr. Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, members. Throughout the program, there were three people that failed because they didn't follow the rules of the program or did not make progress in the treatment program, so they washed out of the program. 43 have made it to supervised release. One was brought back into prison because they violated their additional release program. Three were restructured. So one out of 43 did not make the program. So it's an extraordinarily strong program. I know there are some discussions, and this is not related in this committee, but about exactly how much money was saved. Department of Corrections said through 2007, something like $200,000 was saved. There may be different ways of calculating it that would may make that number even higher. Those of you who were in high school as a senior probably read Pygmalion in your senior English class. And one of the things that struck me in reading Pygmalion was that George Bernard Shaw said, "Take care of the pence and the pounds will take care of themselves." This may be in terms of the budget for the state. We're taking care of the pence financially, but we're getting 40-plus people out into the community to be productive citizens and to work and have families and to be taxpayers again. So this program does indeed work. Madam Chair, that's my testimony.
Good. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If there aren't questions, maybe there are questions or opposition on this part of the bill.
Questions for Senator Ortman or the testifiers on this part of the bill? Mr. Stewart?
Madam Chair, if I could just add one more thing. Of all those contentious issues where we had the 8-7 and 8-8 votes, the expansion of this early release program was the one thing that everybody on this working group agreed on. This was a unanimous vote that you ought to expand this program. And, you know, we wouldn't have had a unanimous vote about whether or not it was raining outside on that committee. So it was quite an achievement that everybody liked this program and said you ought to expand it.
Any questions? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that Mr. Stewart just took away my closing line on this portion of the bill, but that's all right. I would just remind you that corrections folks were on this. There may be, I anticipate that they might not be big fans of this program, but Nonetheless, they were participants in this working group and part of that unanimous recommendation to the legislature that we not just continue this program, but that we expand it so that it is effective. And so I'm hopeful to earn your support. And then with that, Madam Chair, I would hope that we could move on to the other section before I offer amendments on this bill.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, John Stewart again. Section 1 removes the mandatoriness of a six-month sentence for anybody who's convicted of fifth-degree controlled substance violation who has a prior drug offense. This provision would allow either the prosecutor or the judge to move to not impose the 6 months of actual incarceration, but it could be stayed if there were substantial and compelling reasons to do that. One illustration of why this is a good idea to take this 6 months off is a case that I passed out in January when I was here, which is a December Court of Appeals case called State versus Linda Marie Cobb. Ms. Cobb was a woman who was convicted of fifth-degree controlled substance because of a trace amount of drugs that was found in her home. The interesting thing is that while her case was in process, she was out in the community, and she maintained sobriety for 2.5 years. However, she had to go and serve the 6 months in jail because of the mandatory nature of the six-month sentence provided by 152.025 sub 3. I'd like to just briefly read you the conclusion of the Court of Appeals opinion. They're talking about a case called Blum that says this is mandatory. They say, although we are bound by Blum, we are troubled by the legislature's one-size-fits-all approach. As Justice Gilbert noted, and as applicable here, by removing the district court's discretion in sentencing, the legislature has sent the message that even though a person accused of a drug-related crime does everything asked of her by the criminal justice system to rehabilitate herself, the law in terms of minimum sentencing treats her the same as if she had not rehabilitated herself. At a time when our prisons are full and Minnesota has a severe budget shortfall, the rehabilitative achievements of some of our many drug offenders must be taken into account in executing sentences. The facts of this case, that is, Linda Cobb's case, the facts of this case show that respondent remained chemical free for more than 2.5 years as she awaited resolution of the charges. Despite her rehabilitation, mandatory minimum sentencing has abrogated the court's ability to fashion an appropriate sentence. In light of the unnecessarily harsh result in this case, we urge the legislature to reexamine its approach. So that's really about the best story you could have for this Section 1. It doesn't say let those people all go. It doesn't say that they won't be on probation. It doesn't say that they won't be locked up if they mess up. But it does say you're not going to automatically impose the mandatory 6 months.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Stewart's comments about that provision was very appealing to me when we heard it before, and it's part of the judge's recommendation as well as the public defender's recommendations. It is not supported by all of the participants in the working group. And for that reason, there are some very passionate positions against this portion of the bill. And so I'm going to ask that we take it out of the bill, not because I'm not a supporter, but I think there's a better opportunity to discuss it fully. I've signed for introduction the entire working group recommendations as a bill that will be introduced on Thursday, and I think that it makes sense to have this conversation about this portion along with some of the other recommendations that are being made for adjustments in drug thresholds and with the sentencing guidelines. So I'd like to save this portion of the bill, Section 1, for that conversation of the entirety. I'd like to send the conditional release program expansion on its own. And so that would be the purpose of my first amendment, would be to ask the committee to indulge me by taking out Section 1 of the bill. And I believe that Mr. Baucus has prepared an amendment to do just that. Unfortunately, I don't have a copy of it here at the table.
Senator Ortman, I think that I haven't heard anything from members of the committee when the bill was introduced. I think there's some general support for your bill. Since we've had the compelling testimony, and I think the committee is open to considering this concept, do you want to, we could keep the bill in the committee and we can consider the whole package. And forward that, ultimately, all of this is going to end up in Senator Higgins' committee anyways. So,
right.
We could do that. I think that would be a good way to kind of consider the entire package. I think that for someone like this, the bipartisan support for this is pretty compelling, and it would be good to do it as a complete package instead of maybe cutting it apart. So, if we have other people testifying, why don't we get all the testimonies, and then let's hang on and get your bill introduced and get into the committee, and let's do the whole package.
Madam
you want
Chair,
to do that?
I appreciate your suggestion, and I do believe there's bipartisan support for both portions of this bill, and I believe it's going to pass this year. But I do think that we should have that one portion with the working group recommendations and have that full conversation all at once. I'm concerned about the conditional release program. That's a program that I am so very proud of, and I don't want to see it get lost in what might be a very controversial debate about what should happen with the working group recommendations. It's also got a sunset date, and I don't want to see that sunset. If something happens at the end of legislative session and we don't get our bills done, I could ask the committee's indulgence, I would really appreciate if we could send that on its own and onto the Public Safety Finance Committee. Let's get the fiscal note, let's look at that, and get some of our work done on that portion of it so we don't lose the chance to continue and expand that program. I would really appreciate the committee's help with that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
It sounds like Senator Ortman has a second way to get this provision to your committee and my committee, and so we can certainly do that. I think we should also look at some point about whether we just want to repeal this mandatory minimum rather than making a workaround on it. And that can be part of that discussion too when we have that larger piece before us, I think.
So Mr. Baucus, is the A2 amendment what does or is it a separate amendment? I have an A2 amendment here.
Madam Chair, it's an A4 amendment.
Oh, it's an A4 amendment.
It just deletes Section 1.
Senator Ortman, did you want to offer the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair, I'd like to make one change to that amendment if I could, and I've surprised Mr. Baucus with my amendments all day long today, so he's not really surprised that I've surprised him again. But I'm wondering if in this amendment, the A2, if we can also delete the sunset provision. Since it's an author's amendment, I'd like to just take out the fact that this is a sunsetting.
So Senator Ortman wants to move the A2 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape she would like it to be in. And then let's take the A2 amendment, and then we'll take the A4 amendment to delete that section. So Senator Ortman, why don't you?
Madam Chair, I think Council can help clarify.
Okay. Mr. Baucus?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, is it your intent to repeal the sunset or to take the sunset extension out of the bill?
Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair and Mr. Baucus, it's so that there would no longer be a sunset and it would just be a permanent program that doesn't have to face renewal every 2 years.
So we're going to incorporate the repeal of the sunset to the A2 author's amendment. Mr. Baucus?
Madam Chair, if you look on page 3 of the bill, section 6, that's the sunset language. Instead of extending it from 2009 to 2011, you would basically be adding a repealer of subdivision 11 to the repealer that's in section 7. And that's something that I can draft if you're comfortable just voting on as a concept.
I think we're all right with that. On Senator Ortman's motion on the A2 amendment as an author's amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, were we looking?
Senator Scheid?
I'm sorry. We were looking at the A2, did you say?
Yes.
A4.
The A2 amendment is an author's amendment, and so So the A4,
Senator. There's nothing left to the bill now. Yeah. I'm
A4
confused.
Is what you voted
she
on,
didn't
right?
offer the A2.
Right, the A4.
I think it was the A.
I believe Senator Ortman offered the A2 amendment as the author's amendment.
Madam Chair, members, I'm sorry, I wasn't listening when you were saying that. I was doing the repealer. The amendment that Senator Ortman wanted to offer was the A4. That's what deletes Section 1 of the bill. The A2 is a different amendment.
I apologize. All right. Senator Peraso moves to reconsider the motion on the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Ortman withdraws the A2 amendment as amended. Now Senator Ortman moves the A4 amendment as an author's amendment, incorporating in the repeal language.
Repeal of the sunset, Madam Chair.
Pertaining to the sunset. That's in Section 6 of the bill. All those in favor of the author's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Knuth.
I have one comment that I failed to make during my testimony. If it would be appropriate, I'd like to make that comment.
Please.
Madam Chair, members, there's always been a concern and a somewhat of a rivalry between the bill and the section that Senator Ortman's been talking about, and challenge incarceration. My concern about challenge incarceration, and that is there's many who, it's an extraordinarily successful program. Some individuals think that should be the only program as opposed to close to what we've been discussing here. But I have some concerns about eligibility for challenge incarceration. And that is primarily that some people simply may be too old to be part of the boot camp or challenge incarceration. Some may not have the health conditions that they need to go through a boot camp setting. And some simply may have some disabilities that would prohibit them from being part of challenge incarcerations. So for that reason, I don't think that that's a particularly viable alternative to what we've been discussing here.
Members, any questions for Senator Ortman?
It's in the House bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
There is an A3 amendment that had been prepared by Senate counsel. Some folks had come to me to ask if I might offer this amendment for consideration by the committee. And I'll just briefly explain what it does. One of the concerns that the Department of Corrections has identified for them is that in the bill, the commissioner has to make a determination about who is eligible and who is not, must screen and ultimately decide who can participate and who will be released at the end of the program. And that might be a difficult decision to make. And so with that concern, some folks have suggested that we put together a 3-judge panel of retired judges that could be appointed to assist the commissioner and make that that release decision pursuant to this section. And I thought that that was But I thought that that was a reasonable approach. I haven't had an opportunity to really consider that, but I thought that we should have that discussion in the committee and see where that took us, to see if there was strong support or opposition to that among the members or among the community.
So Senator Ortman has offered for the committee's consideration of the A3 amendment. Anybody here who would like to testify on this amendment, particular language? Members, questions for Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I like this idea. Having, it looks like, 3 retired judges to help in the decision, kind of brings a fresh look to the issues, dealing with the conditional release of the offenders, and it doesn't, put all of the decision on the lap of the commissioner, and we'll help maybe make some decisions that can get some people back to a fresh start in the community. And so if this goes forward and goes to our committee, or our division, we can continue to flesh it out if it needs to be done, and continue to put it together. I like the concept.
Madam Chair, I would move the amendment to A3.
Oh. Senator, you didn't move the A3 amendment? You just offered it, right?
Madam Chair, I have not moved it yet, but I support Senator Parisot's motion. I have mixed feelings about this because I know once we do something like this, it creates more expense. It probably ends up having, you know, we end up paying these retired judges to consider, and it will add something to the fiscal note. And so I hope the members of this committee that support that will consider that too, that we may end up having to take it out in order to keep the cost sustainable over time. I'm not sure, but I'd like to see the fiscal note on this. I think if we add it in tonight, then we can get this portion of it considered in the fiscal analysis. And so for that, I think that it makes some sense to add it tonight.
Well, Senator Orman, I think that once this amendment goes on, your bill has to go to GovOps before it can go to finance. So.
Oh, let's not call it an advisory board then.
So, I mean, I think that it'll be fine. You'll just have to go talk to Senator Rest to make sure that we make, you know, the bill makes deadline.
Madam Chair?
Does the department want to comment on this? Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I'm wondering, could we say a panel of three retired judges?
Not call it a board? I like that.
Mr. Backus, does a panel of three versus a Supreme Court appointment relieve us the obligation to send it to GovOps? Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, I don't think the terminology would really have an effect. I don't know for a fact it would have to go to state and local, but it seems like it would be in their jurisdiction if they wanted to see it.
DOC?
Madam Chair, my name is David Christ. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Department of Corrections. And to the present point here, the department has been screening participants into the program on the front end for eligibility. The part of the language in the amendment here says that the commissioner shall consider upon the release procedure whether the offender was involved in criminal gang activity during the prison term, the offender's custody classification, level of violence, and other things. We would prefer to do that on the front end of the screening rather than have a person go through the program and only to have his hopes dashed at the very end by the recommendation of a judge's panel or even a decision by the Department of Corrections. If they're not likely to be released in the interest of public safety, we ought to tell that to the offenders on the front end rather than right at the end of after they've completed the program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I think that's a great comment. I think we need to address it, and I think there's a pretty straightforward way to do that. It would be on line 1.21 to change the word release to eligibility. And then the three-judge panel, Senator Higgins, would be advising on eligibility decisions made under this section. Would that satisfy
Mr. Chris?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I have to say that the department stands in opposition to the expansion of the CRP program in general. And so I couldn't in good faith endorse what Senator Ortman is suggesting there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Assistant Commissioner Christ, why?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, we believe that a more appropriate vehicle for early release or getting people drug treatment, getting them out of prison, is our challenge incarceration program, notwithstanding Mr. Knuth's comments. There are few offenders admitted to Minnesota prisons that are low risk or nonviolent. We are the second lowest per capita state for incarceration. We send a pretty distilled group of offenders to prison in Minnesota. We're also the sixth highest state in use of probation and intermediary sanctions in the community. And among the group of offenders that we think would not represent a risk to the public,
and if released, would be the same kind of fellow that we send to our minimum security facilities. And anecdotally, we believe that we use minimum security less than many, many states in the country as well. Those are the general reasons for our opposition, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Crist, we have been told in the division, and I can't remember if it's been in this committee, but in the division that the challenge incarceration program is about, what, a third to a half empty, as well as the Togo facility is not full. So perhaps what we need is a three-judge panel to help with the eligibility to go into that program. I've had conversations with the administration of DOC and suggested that we expand the eligibility for the CEIP as well, because we spent an awful lot of money to upgrade and make that facility larger, and if it's sitting there not being used, that is not in our best interest at a time that we've got a $7 billion shortfall. I would appreciate it if you would bring forward some ideas on the expansion of the eligibility for CIP. But at this time, I'd like to go forward with this proposal with Senator Ortman's approval, and we'll get it all into the division, and we'll try to work out the funding issues keep working on this language. But we have these procedures in law for a reason, and we need to use them. They were there. They weren't there just on a whim, and that they're not being used to the best of their capacity is just not appreciated by this chair, I know.
Any further discussions on the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair, can I offer an
Senator
oral
Ortman.
Amendment? I wanted to offer the oral amendment to change the word release to eligibility.
Senator Ortman moves that on line 1.21, delete the word release and insert eligibility. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, may I make another oral amendment?
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. The title on 1.20, I'd like to move to change advisory board to panel of judges.
Senator Ortman moves on line 1.20, delete advisory board and insert a panel of
judges.
Judges.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I think you need to change the language on 1.4 as well, possibly.
Okay.
And make the corresponding change on line 1.4.
Correct.
Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now,
Madam Chair,
Senator
if
Ortman.
I could, just to make sure we keep going in the right direction here, I think Senator Parisot had moved the A3 amendment, and we just amended it. So I'm hoping we can adopt the A3 amendment.
Right. So I was just going there, Senator
okay.
Ortman. So on Senator Parisot's motion on the A3 amendment as amended, any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
That's a good day's work.
Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, with that, I would like to move this bill to Senator Higgins' committee.
Senator Ortman moves that Senate File 645, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Hang on a second. Remember, this sends it to GovOps, I think.
It really shouldn't.
Well, anyways, I have people who would like to testify on the bill. So,
we don't know them. Yeah, for sure.
Senator Ortman, why don't we send it to finance? But I'd like you to go talk to Senator Rest. And if she would like the bill, then we would have to make a motion on the floor to re-refer it to her committee.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Mr. Brown, Mr. Anfinson?
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Anfinson was interested in the next bill, the expungement bill.
And Mr. Brown, and you don't need to testify on this, right?
No, thank you.
All right. So on the Senator Ortman's motion to recommend refer Senate File 645 as amended to the Committee on Finance, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Members, I'm really sorry to the members of the public. We're going to take a 30-minute break just to get a breath of fresh air and grab a drink of water and whatever. So, and we'll be back in around 6:30. I hope we don't have to go any longer than maybe 7:30 or 8, unless you all would like a longer break for dinner. Would you like you want an hour so you can have dinner? Yeah? Okay, so then let's recess until 7. All right. The committee is in recess.
Hour, huh?